One Track. Listen.
What's up, everyone? I'm your host, Anthony Joseph Landman. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 5 of One Track, the podcast where I invite today's leading composers and performers of new classical music to answer this simple question. If someone wanted to know your music and you only had one track to play for them, what track would that be? And today, I'll be asking that question to our special guest, composer Alex Shapiro. What's up, Alex?
Hey, I'm really happy to be having this conversation.
I'm so happy to have you on. Thank you for coming on and, yeah, sharing your music with us.
Thanks. So I'm just wondering, I'm going to shoot back a question to you
before we get started,
which is how many, if I'm your fifth person, how many of the others so far have said, well, I will answer this question, but it's impossible to choose one piece that reflects a composer.
I think everyone's complained so far and just
but
said,
it's
so hard. It's a hard question. It is very, very hard. And I realize that, you know, if I asked you and asked these other composers the same question probably next month, you know, the piece might change.
Sure.
But
that's kind of the beauty of it, because, you know, music and creativity are fluid. They're
right.
Never the same thing twice.
That's right.
And they're not the same. It's not the same piece we're writing twice. And listening to pieces, we don't hear them the same way twice. You know, we're always finding something different. So it's an interesting question in that way. And it forces a composer to look a little bit more carefully than they might at their catalog, you know, rolling it back in their head, you know, and thinking about different works that they've done and having that examination. Which sometimes you're just so busy in the moment of whatever you're writing that you don't actually think about the catalog that much.
That's right. Yeah, it's really forced.
So it's an interesting exercise.
Sure. So I'm going to ask you the question. If someone wanted to know your music and you only had one track to play for them, what track would that be?
It would probably be, speaking right now, it would probably be my wind symphony to the sea called Immersion, which is a 3-movement piece about 25 minutes long. And I think it's a good example of the work I've been doing with Electroacoustic Symphonic Wind Band. That repertoire and adding to it. I've written anywhere, I don't know, 9 or 11 pieces. I've lost track in this genre now, and I just love it. And my goal in these pieces is to create a seamless sonic textural organism by which the listener can't tell, you know, where the live musicians or the pre-recorded track begin and end. And that's become a pursuit of mine, is to seek excellence in pursuing this kind of a sound, this holistic approach to sound. So I would choose Immersion just because it has enough music in it and 3 movements, in which there's a bit of contrast, just to point somebody to see the breadth of what I'm doing. It doesn't cover the whole ball of wax, obviously. Nothing does.
Sure.
Because, you know, the voices I have in chamber music or other things are very different and very diverse. And actually, if I were to say anything about my catalog, I would say that some of the pieces you wouldn't believe were written by the same composer, that I have a really broad catalog stylistically, and I'm proud of that. I really like that. And I liken it to cuisine. I always say, you know, we love lots of different kinds of food, and nobody thinks less of us if we, you know, cook Italian one night and do Japanese the next and Indian 2 days after that and an American grilled cheese sandwich, you know, a couple days later. Nobody thinks that's weird. But
right.
For some reason, if we do a lot of different things musically, somehow, you know, we used to, not so much anymore, thank goodness, but there used to be complaints of, well, how can I pin this artist down? They're all over the map. You know, they don't have one particular sound.
Right.
And fortunately, that has changed, because I've always been that kind of an artist. I've always been a chameleon, and always hopefully sounding like Shapiro, not being emulative of someone else's voice, but being really inspired by and open to a lot of different paths toward musical expression.
Sure.
So, So in Immersion, I guess what I like about it, if you want to know, I mean, I don't know if you want to know this, but why I would choose it.
Of course.
But emotionally, which is the most important thing to me in a piece of music, it's really heartfelt, and to me, it's really authentic. That the music really poured out, and I feel like it's very reflective of me, and Also, there's a lot of unabashed beauty in it, as well as unabashed in-your-face aggression, and I like that too, in the middle movement, which is basically sort of a percussion concerto, a very short one. And the music includes aspects that are both tonal and also non-tonally centered, so there's that. And there's some jazz influence and a funk groove section that features four improvising soloists in one of the movements. And then on top of it, also close to my heart is a level of communication and activism and awareness raising. And this piece contains a personal message. It addresses the fragility of the sea and its creatures and our rather dangerous relationship to them, dangerous for them. And so to me, this piece kind of encompasses an awful lot of things that I'm constantly exploring in many of my works. And so that's why I would point to this one.
And you live amongst the sea. I mean, literally. I mean, you're constantly in contact with this this aspect of nature. And I ask this question, but I think it's obvious. You know, that's had a huge impact on your music, I'm sure.
It does. Not on every single piece. You know, I'm not the kelp composer per se, but there are, in a lot of ways it has. Certainly, I have written a lot about water. There's Immersion. There's another symphonic, electroacoustic symphonic wind band piece called Liquid Compass, which also is about the sea and its shifting meters and rhythms. You know, the sea is not in 4/4.
Right.
Just in case anybody was wondering. But I've always lived on the edge of the water. I lived on the edge of the East River when I was growing up in Manhattan. I lived on the edge of the Pacific in Malibu for many, many, many years before I came up here. And I've been up on San Juan Island for almost 10 years now. And I live right at the edge of the water here. And I'm so much a part of the sea that during the storms, the water, the wind drives the waves over my house. And it's an all glass front house, and I literally feel like it's about time to break out the snorkel. I mean, it's quite an experience. Some of my friends have been here when that's happened, or they've seen pictures and video on Facebook or whatever, and it's just wild. And there's no way to separate your emotions from that incredibly visceral experience of being consumed by the sea and watching these storms come right up to your door. It's quite spectacular. And very moving. Of course, I'm watching the sea life go by all the time. I live in a spot with orca whales and humpback whales and and lots of stellar sea lions and harbor seals and dolphins and all kinds of fish, which I get to see brought up to me by bald eagles carrying them away for lunch.
Wow.
And, you know, it's really quite a show. And so there's no way you can be sitting at your desk watching all this go on, like, you know, Mutual of Omaha, Wild Kingdom, and I've got my camera right next to me because I take a lot of wildlife photos. And there's no way for a composer not to be influenced, I feel, by this.
Yes.
I think my heart would still be connected to it, even if I was in the basement in Brooklyn. I'd probably still be fascinated by these things. I'm not saying that someone who's in a basement in Brooklyn cannot write about the sea. Of course they can. But I have that proximity, I guess, that makes it adds another layer, I guess, of authenticity to what I'm doing.
Sure.
And love for what I'm doing, because I see it all the time. You know, I've got a boat. I've had a sailboat or a powerboat for many, many, many years. I've been on the sea, kayaking, et cetera, snorkeling, anything I can do to be close to the creatures. And it's magical.
It sounds like it.
Really
amazing. Can you tell us, I don't know, how this piece came into existence?
Let's see. How did it come into existence? It was the second band piece, I think, second or third band piece, second electroacoustic band piece for which I'd been commissioned. And it was a small consortium, just seven colleges. And I can't name them all. Yes, I can name them all. The lead consortium partner was University of Minnesota, and then also involved were the Ohio State University and Yale University and University of Wisconsin-Whitewater and Rosemont High School in Rosemont, Minnesota, and University of British Columbia. And anyway, all of these schools were involved in bringing the commission to life back in 2011. And it came about because once I realized I wanted to use this kind of a subject matter, I wanted to write about my environment. And I was going through, I knew it would be electroacoustic, and I happened to be going through some of my solo electroacoustic pieces. And there were a couple of pieces that I had written for solo instruments that had tracks that I really was compelled to see about using again in this format and orchestrating with the same track or the accompaniment track, orchestrating from a solo voice vertically to an entire symphonic wind band. And I asked my commissioners if they would be up for that, if two out of the three movements, I had very specific ideas of which tracks I wanted to adapt, basically. And I sent them to them, and I said, how would you feel about this for a wind band? And they all were very enthusiastic. They said, yes, yes, yes. And I thought, great. And then the second movement, I wrote from scratch, the track and the piece. And so that's how it began. The first movement is called Depth, and it came initially from a popular piece of mine that was initially written for contrabassoon called Deep, which has had many lives for many different low solo instruments. It just lent itself to this anthem that I could hear in my head for full wind band. So that's the first movement. The second movement is an anthemic, slower, grand kind of piece, about 7.5 minutes or something. And then the second movement, I knew I wanted something fast and furious. And that one's called Surface. And we might hear that later in the show. And it's very contrasting and really very percussive and, very different mood. And then the third movement I used the track of a piece of mine for contrabass flute and electronics called Below, which Peter Sheridan had recorded a number of years earlier. And Tessa Brinkman has just recorded it for a CD that's about to come out. And I should say that Carolyn Beck was the one that recorded Deep back in, 2004 or something, maybe earlier. I can't remember all the dates. But at any rate, Below really struck me because not only did it have the track, but in the track, I used the heart-wrenching sound of a humpback whale song. And I use it really as a duet partner for the flute. Mm-hmm. So I thought, wouldn't this be interesting to make it for whale and a stage full of people, 100 people on stage? Wouldn't that be beautiful? And so that's how that came about. And I was so grateful that the commissioners were up for that because I was perfectly willing to, do all three tracks for all three movements completely from scratch. And that's how I usually work. But these two, I had just had a hankering to orchestrate these.
Yeah.
And I was really happy. It worked out.
Do you want to listen to the first two excerpts here?
Sure. Why don't we start with the contrabass flute, the end part. It's of the contrabass flute version of Below, which is Peter Sheridan on flute, and the track I produce and record here in my studio. And then we can go from that. I thought it would be interesting for listeners, if they're curious, to hear the difference between the solo flute version and then the same excerpt, the same place in the music for full band. And what really fascinated me about this, and I wasn't even expecting this when I did it, but Below, for the solo contrabass flute, very low flute, was a very intimate piece. It was just the sultry low flute and the plaintive high voice of the humpback. There's octaves between them, and you always think of a flute as being high and a whale being big. But here, the flute's very, very low and the whale's quite high. Hmm. And so that was a really intimate approach to the music, and I loved that version of it. But then when I was orchestrating it, and you guys hopefully will hear this in the music, it's not the greatest recording because it's a live recording from the premiere in the hall with the University of Minnesota. It's not a studio recording yet, but you'll get the idea. And suddenly this stuff that was really intimate became really grand and majestic once I expanded it to band. And it's the exact same material. All I did, I added some harmonies and things. But I think it's a really interesting lesson, like a composition or orchestration lesson, to see how the entire meaning of the music can really shift just with something like this. So, simultaneously, it can have two very different emotional lives, I guess. It's fascinating.
Absolutely.
Well, fascinating to me. Your mileage might vary. I could be boring the heck.
This will be really interesting. we're going to hear these back to back, and and we'll get to hear everything that you just pointed out. So let's check out these first two excerpts. The first one is from Below. The second one is from Beneath.
Beneath.
Yeah, I think you were totally right in your description of that. The band version, you know, when that whale song comes in really, really high, it's so powerful. In the, you know, the band version is like, ooh, it's like this, I don't know, powerful wave of of emotion,
it's,
you know?
It's otherworldly.
Yeah.
The sound is just otherworldly. You know, they also, and it's impossible for a recording to capture it, but live, when you've got 100 people on stage playing and getting louder and louder, and that's a particularly very loud double forte moment in the piece when they all build up to that point, it's just, it shakes you in your sternum when you're there.
I'm sure.
And it's so fun to get that kind of power. I love writing for solo instruments, but I was like a kid in a candy shop when I discovered the joy of electroacoustic symphonic wind band, because, boy, you've got all these people on stage, and then you've got the surround sound, so to speak, you know, of what's coming out of the speakers. So you're really enveloping the audience in a wash of sound and texture that is just unlike any other experience that I've been able to have.
Let me ask you a question, because I've never done a piece like this with like an electroacoustic track playing with a live group.
Mm-hmm.
Is it a challenge? I mean, obviously you figured this out, but just from my own sort of, I don't know, perspective, clueless perspective, is it a challenge to sync this, like for the players in the band to sync this up, to get it exactly right, you know, with that climax we just heard with the whale song, and then they just hit it right there? Is it, yeah, how do you do that?
I'll tell you how the sausage is made. I'll tell you how we do it. It's very much like a Hollywood recording session. The conductor has earbud playing a click back in her or his earbud, right? And they're connected to a laptop playing back the track. So only the conductor actually hears a click to which they conduct. If we were on a Hollywood soundstage, we'd have headphones for all of the players. They'd be listening through at least one ear, probably. But instead, what we have on stage are usually three monitors, one back by the percussion, and then one on either side of the band stereo so that the band can get a sense of the track as well and where they are. But usually they don't really hear it that well because bands are loud and they're too busy listening to themselves and the person sitting next to them. I mean, you know, if you're in the trombone section, you're pretty much only hearing that. So the way it works is there are two different kinds of click tracks. One is called a fixed click. And for a groove-based piece or something with a constant tempo, sure, you would just do that. It just clicks away, and it just changes downbeat when the meters change. In this case, this particular movement beneath for the band uses what we call a variable click, where I'm able to build into the click the rubato and the lilt of the music to make it as lifelike as possible. So I'm conducting from here. The challenge is for the conductor to give up that power, to get used to the fact that they will always be driven by the tempi in the track. They can give away a little time, but they have to make it up somewhere else. You know, once they know the track very well, that sure they can slow down a little bit more someplace, but then they're going to have to catch up very gracefully somewhere else. You can do it, but I build in that to the click. And then the other challenge is that yes, the musicians have to watch the conductor with really great precision and really stay together, even though they may feel musically like speeding up or whatever. This even happens in groove pieces. People get excited, the piece gets going, and they want to go a little faster, you know? And so they have to watch the conductor like a hawk. So those are the challenges. And it usually works really, really well. It just takes, you know, a run through to kind of get the hang of it. I've been with a number of conductors in seminars and workshops where they're doing this for the first time, and it's really fun to watch them experience having a click in their ear for the first time. And it's awkward for the first few measures. It's like, whoa, what is this? And then you understand it. And then usually I offer the click by itself and also the click, a version of it with the track mixed in. And that way that you can lay it into the tracks in, you know, in Audacity or GarageBand or whether it's iTunes, whatever they're playing it back in, and they can adjust the levels. And then with some pieces, especially ones that are a little bit more fluid and a little bit more ambient, I'll even add a version of the click that has my voice on the rehearsal bar numbers. So for instance, just to make sure that the conductor doesn't get lost if it's a very floaty woo-woo piece, you know, that's a technical term, right? And so I'll say, you know, measure 24, measure 42. You know, it'll be like having the composer on the conductor's shoulder.
Wow.
And I think that can be very, very helpful. So the composer's job, when you're putting together a piece like this, first of all, you're a record producer as well as a composer, right? Because you're having to produce the track and many versions of the click and all of this. But you're also having to take into account all the resources that the players and most of all your conductor are going to need to be able to do this easily. My attitude is if I'm asking people to do something that's a little out of the norm, it's up to me to make it as joyous and fun and easy for them as possible to make music, you know, and not have to worry about all this stuff. So I try to do that. You know, every one of the download pages that the purchasers get for these pieces includes a lot of resources and a whole PDF of several pages talking about different ways to work the tech setup and different resources. So I try to hold everybody's hand. And then, of course, you know, the great thing about a living composer, right, is we're available. We answer our emails. Sousa never answered a damn email. Let me just tell you that. So I try to be very helpful. But, yes, you are absolutely right. There are a lot of challenges with this, but they get overcome really quickly, I think, from what I've seen. There haven't been a lot of crash and burn moments, fortunately.
Oh, that's super interesting. I know you had a life at one time as a film composer.
Right.
Is this something that you took from that world?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
I think I took two things from it. One was my love of a really big, big sound, because so much of film music is electroacoustic. It's often mostly synth and then some live musicians overlaid, right? And then under better circumstances, it's mostly orchestra with some other tracks added. But that's really common, of course, in Hollywood. And so that was common to me. And that's how, when I started doing concert music later in my career, when I was about 37, I decided I wanted to stop doing commercial music and really focus on chamber music. And when I did, I was writing mostly acoustic pieces, but I was gradually adding more electroacoustic pieces for soloists into my catalog, and I was loving it. And those did not include a click, because when you're only working with one person, they really don't need a click.
Right.
I've got one piece that's very complicated, kettle brew, for percussion, that does have a click, but all the others don't, because the soloist knows where they are in the track, and there's no conductor. But the minute you've got a group of people and certainly a conductor, you know, you've got to put that click in, and that certainly I learned from all those years working in studios is, oh, this is how you do it. This is how we do it, you know, for a film cue. This is no different. So it's sort of fun when I'm working with bands, I get to tell them that they're doing the same thing that we do in Hollywood. And I think, especially for some of the younger players, they think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I mean, it is very cool. Let's move on to our second sort of pair of excerpts here from Below and Beneath. Do you want to set this up for the audience?
Sure. They're short, and it was just an example. This is a middle part of that same third movement. So this actually happens before what we just heard. And it's sort of a groove section. And what I did in the in both cases, for both pieces, it's improvisatory. And I just wanted to show the listeners the difference between one person improvising. And in the case of Peter, what we chose to do is a lot of extended techniques, a lot of chuffing and blowing, and you'll hear what he's doing. It's pretty cool. And then in the case of the band, it gave me a really great opportunity to invite members of the band to stand up and take a solo, you know, in a jazz format, which is not done a whole lot in that genre.
Right.
And I think it needs to be done more, because I would love to see every instrumentalist able to improvise. And somehow we're scared out of doing that at a young age if we're classically trained, and there's no need for that. So I always see my work as a composer as also my ability to open a portal for other people, you know, and this was one way to open the portal of improv and you know, being able to stand up and take a solo.
Nice.
To some people who might not usually do it. Because even though I mark solos for in the score, for I think in the score they're marked for pretty standard instruments, I think tenor sax, alto sax, trumpet, and vibes. But I make it clear that the conductor should feel free to choose any strong players in the band. It could be the oboist, which I would love, because, you know, oboes don't get a chance to play in jazz band, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It could be anybody who wants to solo can do it. And then what I do in the score, and this is just, I say this to my composer friends listening, is I did write in an Osea line so that if there's nobody in the band that wants to solo, at least it's covered. You know, they can play the ink. They can play the ink if they have to. But I say in a text box that they're really encouraged to solo and do their own thing. That, you know, I like to say that to them when I'm rehearsing with them, if I get the chance, you know, in residencies and stuff, I always say, or over Skype, you know, I do a lot of Skype rehearsals, and I'll say, there are no wrong notes. Some are a little bit better sounding next to each other than others, but there are no wrong notes.
Right.
So I try to, you know, I just think people should feel free. You know, what's the worst that can happen, right? Nobody's going to die. It's just music.
Right.
So I try to encourage people to get out of their skin a little bit. So everything I said is far longer than these two excerpts, so we can roll them. First is with Below and Peter Sheridan, and then the next one is Beneath with the band.
Okay, let's hear it. They must have had so much fun.
Fun.
They did. Now, do we have the same tech thing, or can you hear me fine? Or are you getting an echo again?
Oh, I can hear you fine.
Oh, great.
So we'll just
They had a really good time with this. And as you can tell from the music, on the band version, I really treated that section of the piece like a jazz chart. You know, and I have the band doing fills mm-hmm. around the improv. And I like mixing it up like that. I want to be able to, you know, have them in the same piece, play very, you know, straight ahead stuff. And then bring some jazz elements into it, too. They should be enjoying all of this, you know. I don't believe in segregating music. I think they had a good time. I love hearing what people do with the solos, because obviously everyone is different. And I like giving people that chance to do that.
Absolutely. It's so cool that you gave them that chance.
Thanks.
Yeah. This last excerpt. Can you set this up for us?
Sure. Surface is the second movement, and this is just a 40-second excerpt from that, just for contrast, because the story behind this, its relationship to the sea, is the chaos of life and death struggles that I see on a very regular basis in front of my desk when I'm writing. In this case, I was trying to figure out what I knew I wanted this, the middle movement, to be very contrasting to the other two and very, you know, fast and furious. And I knew I wanted it to be very percussive, and I knew I wanted to really feature, in this case, some marching band percussion on stage, which isn't done very often. Yeah. And now I know why, actually, because the marching band people and the symphonic wind band people are very different worlds musically. But nonetheless, I got the go-ahead to do it. It was really fun. Can you imagine 5 marching bass drums on stage, right?
Oh, nice.
And 5 marching toms and the whole thing. It was really fun. It's really fun. But the substitutions can be made. You know, I'm not a stickler for it. But at any rate, I was trying to figure out, what am I going to do musically here? So, and at the moment that I was holding my head in my hand thinking, oh my gosh, I don't have any good ideas, which is pretty much standard for any working composer, as you well know. That's mm-hmm. how we start everything is, oh my God, I'm a fraud. I have no ideas. Every single composer I know, no matter how famous or unfamous, says the exact same thing. And then I'm looking out my window and I see this big splash and it gets my attention. And I grab my camera, and sure enough, about 30 yards in front of me, very close to me, is this life and death struggle of a seal, a harbor seal, and a giant red Pacific octopus, which the seal is trying to have for lunch. And it's this huge set of tentacles. This is a very large octopus. And the tentacles are wrapped around the head of the seal. And they are struggling, and it's just flail, 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 and tentacles are flying, and the whiskers are flying, and the teeth are grinding against the octopus, and then all of a sudden, everything gets really quiet. They go underwater, boom, 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 and then, boom, they're up above the water again, and they're flailing. Anyway, I'm watching this, and I'm taking pictures of it. Some of them are up on the Immersion website on my webpage, and boy, did I get my idea. That's all I needed. So what you're going to hear is pretty much the end of the piece, I think. This is how it all ends. It does not end well for the octopus. I will give it away. Not that one could tell from this music, but here we go. This is the end of Surface.
Okay.
Attention by the end of that one.
Your story puts it in a whole new light too.
I love telling that story to audiences when I have a chance to do this in person. You know, obviously I don't go to most of my performances, but when I am around for one of these performances, I act out the whole struggle. You know, I'm flailing around on stage, which is wonderfully unladylike, and it's pretty hilarious. And I just love bringing this to life for people, because, you know, this is where the notes come from, right? It's where the stuff comes from, and I want to connect with audiences so much. I want them to have visceral, feeling, connected experiences, multimedia experiences, in a sense, you know, when they're listening to my stuff. So So yeah, that was the end of the second movement there. Bye bye octopus. And then the next day I would see octopus tentacles washing up on shore, and watching gulls try to maneuver these and eat them was hilarious, because the gulls, they're heavy, you know, and the gulls were tugging at them, but it's rubbery and they couldn't get any meat off of it, and they'd be dragging them around with a lot of struggle, you know, to drag these things around. It was very, very funny. I mean, not for the octopus. I feel badly for the octopus.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah.
But watching everybody else deal with the tentacles was pretty funny.
Well, are there any parting words that you'd like to leave us with about this or your music as a whole?
Just that I would like to think that my body of work represents what I encourage every one of our peers to do, which is to seek truth in what they hear and to share that with other people. That don't worry about what other people think you should be writing. Don't
absolutely
listen to other noises around you or critics or everything. If you feel really strongly about what you're hearing in your head, and if you feel that you do it well, or, you know, reasonably well enough, then that's what you should be doing. And I think that's the best advice. That's what I'd want people to think of with my work, is that it's, at least whether they like it or not, it's definitely mine. And, you know, it sounds like me. And it's what I always want to recommend to my friends, that they follow their heart and write the music they want to hear and completely turn down the noise around them from other people's opinions. You know, just follow your heart. That tends to lead to good things, because I think that people hear authenticity in our work. They hear when it's really genuine and coming from you.
Yes.
And conversely, they can also hear when maybe somebody's just trying to sound like someone else, you know, or whatever, thinking that that'll get them approval. Never worry about getting approval. One of the greatest things about being middle-aged and older is that you stop worrying so much about approval. It's terrific. I highly recommend aging. I really do. And so one of the best things is just not giving a rat's ass anymore about what people think, and, and doing the work that gives you joy and that means something to you. And then you will find other people to whom it resonates.
Yeah.
So. And imagine, words.
I mean, imagine if you didn't give a rat's ass, you know, when you were 21, you know, so all you 21-year-olds out there, you know, don't worry so much about what other people think.
That's right.
Right from your heart. Yeah, that's great. Great advice. Where can the audience find you?
They can easily find me online at www.alexshapiro.org. Remember, it's O-R-G, and that's A-L-E-X-S-H-A-P-I-R-O.org. And I also am pretty darn present on Facebook. So friend me if you are listening and want to see posters of the wildlife and other pictures, rather photographs of the wildlife that I post. You'll see them on Facebook as well as my website, but you'll see them on Facebook fast. So join me on Facebook. And awesome. I tweet occasionally. I do all the things that one does, but Facebook is my favorite social media place.
Awesome.
So,
Well, thank you so much for coming on, Alex. I'm just so thrilled that you could come and share your music.
Well, I want to thank you for featuring not only me, but all the composers and musicians you have and will be featuring for this wonderful podcast, Anthony. I think it's a great idea. And it's just, we all love to hear how people work and think and what they're doing. So thank you for doing this service for everybody.
Oh,
it's
thank
wonderful.
You. It's my pleasure. If you would like, and please feel free, don't be shy. If you'd like to contact me and ask me a question, suggest somebody, even suggest yourself or whatever, email us at onetrackpodcast@gmail.com. These all use the number one. Our website is onetrackpodcast.com. We're on Twitter at onetrackpodcast, and also we're on Facebook. And we'll see you all next week for an all new One Track. Later.
Listen.